I wonder how many answers are people going to want from us from this episode?
Probably quite a few.
Maybe 42?
42!
It's episode 42!
Happy birthday, sort of, kind of. 42 to us!
42! I'm sure most of our listeners know the significance of 42.
Yes, yes. We are the answer to life, the universe, and everything.
Or at least bizarre bits of history within life, the universe, and everything.
Oh, I got tickets on myself.
Oh, good. That's all I really wanted to say in the waffle.
42. Thank you, Douglas Adams.
Absolutely.
You were sadly missed, sir. I salute you. I was probably doing the wrong way.
That doesn't really matter, but I'll have to get my signed copy of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy later now.
Show off.
Yeah, well. Jeez. I've got a signed copy of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Show off.
And since we are late with this episode, I think we better go with it.
For various reasons.
Yes.
Yes.
Chaos.
Pure, utter chaos. And not even the chaos that I like. Not good chaos.
What the... Hello and welcome to the What the History podcast.
Woohoo!
Your fortnightly bits of bizarre history to make you say what the history.
Come and have nommies.
Indeed, very tasty treats indeed. I am one of your hosts, Trevor Holland, and I am joined by...
Susie Holland.
Woohoo!
Hey, me.
And we should power on through. Susie, what bizarrity do you have for us this evening?
Yes, bizarrity is... Yeah, kind of my bag, obviously. I wouldn't be doing this podcast otherwise. But, okay, I want to tell you about something that is actually an Australian story with an English twist, if that makes any sense. But anyway, monarchs in Australia love when British royals come out to tour our country. Trev, stop shaking your head. You're not a monarchist. I am. It's a link to the old country. We love our royal weddings, engagements, christenings, crazy hats. Thank you, Beatrice and Eugenie. No one can top that. And testament to these are the amount of people that tuned into the last royal wedding between Harry and Meghan. By the magazines, they have even a sniff of royal news contained within to feast our eager eyes on, or have stories of long-deceased royals that still capture our attention. But did you wonderful what the historians know that in our first royal visit in 1867 and 1868, there was also the first political assassination attempt, and the attempt was made on the visiting royal. What the indeed. The royal in question was the second son and fourth child of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, Prince Alfred, the Duke of Edinburgh. His other titles were Earl of Kent and Earl of Ulster, with the would-be assassin being Irish-born Catholic, Henry James O'Farrell. The attempt didn't succeed, but the ramifications were huge. Let me explain. The Duke enjoyed visiting Adelaide, Hobart, Melbourne, Brisbane, and Sydney, which he liked so much that he visited twice. It was on his second visit to Sydney that the Duke agreed to visit Clontarf, a popular picnicking spot on the foreshore of Sydney Harbour. He went for a benefit picnic for the Sydney Sailors' Home, a philanthropic organisation to provide affordable and safe accommodation for visiting sailors. The picnic was organised by Sydney politician and barrister William Manning. Rumours of possible sectarian violence between Catholics and Protestants were abound, but the Duke paid no heed and attended the picnic. During his time in Melbourne, there was a shooting incident between Protestant Orangemen and Catholics, and also a riot. Enter Henry James O'Farrell, who with his Smith & Wesson handguns crept up behind the Duke and shot him in the back at close range, wounding him. Cries of, "The Duke is shot, and he is shot and fallen down dead," from witnesses who hastily tackled Henry to the ground with the intent of lynching him on the spot. However, Henry was spirited away and promptly arrested. The Duke was nursed by Florence Nightingale, trained Lady Superintendent of Sydney Hospital, Lucy Osborne, newly arrived in Sydney. By sheer good fortune, the Duke survived, the bullet glancing off his ribs, and once it was removed, made a full recovery. These events were set against a backdrop of fierce sectarian violence in the colonies and also in Britain. Australians needed only to pick up the newspaper to read about ongoing battles of the Fenian terrorists in England, those who opposed British rule in Ireland, and many people were shocked, ashamed, and sought vengeance against Henry, who, as he was being led away after the shooting, told stunned onlookers that, and I quote, "I'm a bloody Fenian, and I'll die for my country," adding that he had done his duty for Ireland. In the days that followed, there were meetings around Australia called indignation meetings, and fueled by English pride and hatred towards Catholic and the Irish, with increased love and respect for the old country, newspapers such as the Sydney Morning Herald and Empire, a newspaper founded by politician Henry Parkes in 1850, added fire to the hatred of Irish Catholics, with reports on the meetings and editorials about the shooting. In New South Wales Parliament, the aforementioned Henry Parkes quickly passed an act called the Treason Felony Act, making it a punishable offence to refuse to drink to Queen Victoria's health, to utter anti-British rule sentiments, and houses were searched, looking to find anti-British rule or pro-Fenian propaganda papers and or weapons, with punishment being from 7 years jail to life imprisonment. Henry Parkes attempted unsuccessfully to uncover a bigger Fenian plot in Australia. Despite paying spies and organising gangs of private investigators, giving rise to the theory that Henry O'Farrell acted on his own accord. Henry was not of sound mental health, having been part of several failed businesses and studying to become a priest, and succumbed to drinking, epileptic fits and erratic behaviour. With his dislike of British rule and fueled by newspaper stories of Fenian uprisings in England, Henry was quickly put on trial with a jury made up of ashamed and shocked jurors, and despite his defence attempting to obtain medical supports that would vouch for his mental health instability, and even Queen Victoria and the Duke asking for clemency, Henry James O'Farrell was found guilty and sentenced to hang, and was hung at Darlinghurst Jail on the 21st of April 1868. Today, the O'Farrell trial is seen by a lot of forensic psychiatrists and criminal lawyers to be a case where vengeance was more important than justice. One of my sources advises that Henry Parkes saw the case as an opportunity to, and I quote, prosecute his moral animosity towards Irish and Catholics, end quote. Anti-Irish sentiment ran high, with Irish police, politicians and government officials losing their jobs, and women were advised not to wear green. Catholic archbishops were pressured to give their loyalty to England, and job advertisements stated, Irish need not apply. With O'Farrell's final confession to Henry Parkes that there was no Fenian conspiracy, he previously told Parkes that he didn't act alone, there was no further attempts to locate Fenians. The Queen and the British government made it clear that there was going to be no further question of Australia's loyalty to British rule, and peace reigned again. The would-be assassination was dead. The Duke survived, and all was good with England. The Duke's visit started with goodwill and ended with Henry O'Farrell's death, further fueling sectarian tensions. These tensions of paranoia, guilt by association, moral panic, miscarriages of justice, and prejudice still occur today, 150 years later. And that is the end of that story.
Wow, it's surprising that it took that long for someone to do an assassination attempt in Australia, but I guess it was still a pretty young country at the time.
It was a young country at the time. It's a young country by European standards.
Very true.
Yeah.
I guess it still is by European standards.
It sure is. Yeah. That surprised me, because I didn't know anything about a assassination attempt on a visiting royal back then. I just came across a ABC news story, and I said, this sounds really interesting. So I researched, as I do, and and just presented all that for you.
Being somewhat of a pacifist, but also a anti-monarchist and with strong Irish heritage, I'm a bit lost when it comes to this story. Don't really know where to look or find things.
Is this your attempt at a segue?
So anyway, after my rather butchered segue, because I can't really think of any other comparison between these stories.
Okay, let it rip.
I better get on with it.
Yes.
Every now and then, you hear about something and think, why did I never know that? But to be honest, that could be a way to describe some of the things that inspired this very podcast.
Absolutely.
My what the this time around is examining a very unique achievement in Olympic history. Every 4 years, the best athletes in the world descend upon the host country, hoping to do their countries proud and beat the records of the previous competitors. I somehow think there is one record that will continue to stand for a very long time. To find out more, we have to travel back to 1911, where Japanese high school student Shizo Kanakuri decided to compete in trials for the Olympic marathon. It had been decided a few years earlier, in 1908 to be precise, by International Olympic Committee member Pierre de Coubertin, I think, that since sport could be a reason to have peace, then Asian countries needed to be included. So it was that Japan ended up sending a team of two athletes to the 1912 Stockholm Olympic Games. Shizo Kanakuri had qualified for the marathon, and his countryman Yahiko Mishima was to compete in a number of sprinting events. The Japan Times were conservative in their reporting of this endeavour, saying, quote, "As this is the first time Japanese runners, or any Japanese athletes, have taken part in these world contests, it is impossible to say what they will achieve. But both are full of grit and nerve and may be counted upon for doing credit to themselves and to Japan." End quote. It soon turned out that the lack of experience was not the only factor causing concerns for young Shizo. In order to get to Stockholm, he had to spend 10 days on the Trans-Siberian Railway, after a boat trip, by the way, and he had to rely on brief opportunities to run around railway stations when the train stopped. And once they got to the Olympic City, one of the officials travelling with the Japanese party fell ill, and since Shizo was the youngest, it fell upon him to care for the sick man, eating further into his already scarce training opportunities. To add to this, Shizo also discovered the local food did not sit well with him, making him tired and queasy. Finally, the big day came, and on July 14, 1912, Shizo took his place amongst the 68 starters for the Olympic marathon. It also happened to be one of the hottest days Stockholm had seen, with the temperature soaring to an unseasonal 32 degrees Celsius, or 90 Fahrenheit, depending on where you're listening. The athletes wore hats and draped damp towels over their heads in an effort to alleviate the heat, and reportedly were quite stunned by Shizo's choice of footwear. He was wearing traditional Japanese tabi, a two-toed canvas shoe. He had added extra canvas to the soles of the shoes, but they still weren't very effective for the rocky path he was about to run. Given these conditions, and Shizo's belief that sweating increased fatigue, which meant that he had abstained from drinking any liquids before the race, it is almost surprising that he made it halfway through the marathon before collapsing and passing out from hyperthermia. Hyperthermia, extreme overheating. Over half the racers failed to complete the marathon, with one unfortunate Portuguese athlete, Francisco Lazaro, collapsing in the extreme heat and unfortunately never regaining consciousness before dying the following morning. Mm. When they took his temperature after he collapsed, his body temperature was 42 degrees.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Luckily for Shizo, a banker and his family were having a garden party nearby and decided to aid the stricken young athlete. They took him in, let him rest, and helped him to rehydrate. After an hour, Shizo made the decision to retire from the race before heading back into Stockholm and catching the first boat back to Japan. Now, this probably wouldn't have been notable, except the shame he felt for not completing the race meant that Shizo did not let any of the organisers in Stockholm know he was leaving, and he was promptly reported as missing, complete with a frantic search throughout the country by the Swedish police. Meanwhile, back in his home country, Shizo found that he did not have much to be ashamed of. His countrymen also did not perform well, and the Japan Times was sympathetic, stating, quote, "It will be unfair to deal harshly with these young athletes for their faults," end quote, before going on to heavily criticise a system that would send athletes to the Olympics with so little preparation. Shizo was also optimistic, reportedly saying, quote, "This failure will beget success," End quote. Despite remaining listed as missing in Sweden for the next 50 years or so, Schiezer went on with his running career. He was much better prepared for the 1916 Berlin Olympics, at least until World War I prevented him from competing, and he finally placed a decent 16th in the 1920 Antwerp Olympics held in Belgium. He also helped to establish the Tokyo Hakone Roundtrip College Ekiden Race in 1920. This was a 218-kilometre relay race where university teams competed. It also helped popularise long-distance running in Japan, where Schiezer was ultimately considered the father of the Japanese marathon, and the grand prize for the race ultimately was named after him. But what of the missing persons case back in Sweden? Well, eventually, an official finally worked out what happened. And so it was that in 1967, the Swedish National Olympic Committee reached out to the now 75-year-old Schiezer, inviting him back to Stockholm under the guise of the 55th anniversary of their games. When he got to Stockholm, Schiezer discovered that he was a bit of a legend. He was known as the missing marathoner, the man who had vanished without a trace on that hideously hot day way back in 1912. As a promotion to help raise funds to send their team to the upcoming games in Mexico, the officials asked Schiezer if he would like to finish the race. Schiezer was delighted and reportedly ran joyfully around the last corner of the course before running through a special ribbon, and this is where he set his most impressive record. The officials read out his time to complete the marathon, being 54 years, 8 months, 32 minutes, and 20.3 seconds, thereby recording the longest time to complete an Olympic marathon.
I love this.
When asked if he would like to say a few words about his achievement, Schiezer went up to the microphone and said, quote, "It was a long trip. Along the way, I got married, had 6 children and 10 grandchildren," end quote.
Oh, bless.
Schiezer lived to the grand age of 93, dying peacefully in 1983 with his Olympic record surprisingly still standing. I would like to add my congratulations to him for this most amazing record in What the History. Well done, sir. Well done. I love that so much.
Such a great story.
She's just my hero.
He's a great guy. He's a great guy. Oh, was a great guy. Yay, Schiezo. We love you.
Yay.
And welcome to the archives of What the History.
Mm-hmm. And we love everyone out there who waited so patiently for this much-delayed episode of What the History.
Thank you, guys. It has been a roller coaster these last few weeks.
It's been up and down. Anyway, yeah. We should not go into details.
No, that's all good.
Now, if you would like to know more about anything that we've discussed in this episode, there are links to our sources in the podcast description down below, or you can head to our homepage, wthpod.rufusproject.com, where you can find all our previous episodes and all our links to all our references. While you're there, you can even leave comments for us below the episodes. Or if you want to chat with us in other ways, you can contact us via email at wthpod@rufusproject.com. Find the What the History podcast page on Facebook, or search pod_what on Twitter, or even use the hashtag WTHpod. We would love to hear from you.
We would.
And we would love to hear if you can think of any other records that compare to 54 years, 8 months, 32 minutes, and 20.3
seconds. 20.3
seconds. It's a point three that really makes it.
It is. Oh, gosh, what a great story.
Yeah, absolutely.
What a great story. I really like that one.
Okay, and...
Woohoo,
yes. I think there's probably nothing else we really need to add to that. Thank you very much for listening, and we will be back in a couple of weeks' time with 2 more bizarre bits of history to make you say,
What the History? Good night, everyone.
Farewell.